Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this first talk on day two. Just a general announcement. You have the ability to give feedback to this talk, to every talk yesterday, and every talk yet is about to come. Just go out to the schedule online, to the detail page of maybe this talk or every other talk, and click on this feedback link, and then there's an anonymous questionnaire just to give you the ability to give feedback. Use it. Speakers and everybody organizing this event will be grateful. Thank you. And now for this talk, first talk on day two. This talk will be about some future possibilities. What if there's no privacy anymore? What can be done? How should anyone feel? What should anybody do? And our speaker is Plom Lom Pom, and he is personally interested in the future. And welcome him. Give him some applause.
Thank you, and thanks for this nice introduction. So I'm talking about embracing post-privacy, and I want to give some optimism towards a future where there is nothing to hide. The reason is that maybe you remember John Gilmore's keynote yesterday, where he said that it's important that we develop new ideas of how to deal with the developments concerning privacy. And so I hope to shake up a little the way we think about things like the identity and freedom in relation to this thing, privacy, by maybe offering some new views and by speculating a little about how the world might change and how things like freedom, identity, and so on might change in a world where privacy is going down. So to give you a little overview about the structure of the talk, I start pessimistically by describing how privacy is ending. Then, when privacy is something that has been once and is something as a matter of history, then through that perspective, I want to look at what it meant, this thing, privacy, and historically. And then, with privacy lost, but still a future to come, I want to speculate a little about what such a future could look like. And we are all familiar with post-privacy dystopias, like, for example, George Orwell's 1984. But because I'd like to live in a happy future, I also want to develop some utopias, and or at least offer some ideas to throw into the room to think about and discuss. So that's the third part. Then I'll offer one slide with some reading recommendations that influenced me a little. And then, if time is still left, I hope we can have a little discussion. So, you read 1984 when you were a child, and you always hoped that this would never happen, and then suddenly you wake up to find out, well, we live in a world where privacy is ending, and where, for example, surveillance becomes more and more ubiquitous, and you start to worry. And you find out that, unfortunately, privacy is doomed. There's this huge privacy-eating monster, a huge global information machinery that consists of surveillance cameras, the internet, and so on, a huge information machinery that eats information, that incorporates information and takes it away from you, and thereby takes away from you privacy. And the problem with this information machinery is that the better it is fed, the greater its stomach grows, and the more hungry it becomes, so it never stops eating more and more privacy away from you. The more it is eating, the more it is growing. It becomes, for example, more ubiquitous. In the past, you only had relatively few interfaces through which you could lose information to this information machinery. You had, for example, your desktop PC at home or at work. Now you have your mobile phones, you have sensors everywhere, you have RFID chips and so on and so on, all mechanisms to collect information about you. The privacy-eating monster also becomes more and more attractive. That is, for example, in the past, it was a little unattractive for most people to put information on the internet, but in the age of Web 2.0, for example, it becomes very easy, for example, to blog, to upload media and so on, and it becomes more sexy, more attractive, everything is in nice colors, has round edges and so on, and you start less and less to worry about what you are, that you are putting stuff on the internet. And this privacy-eating monster is becoming more and more intelligent. That is, better and better algorithms are developed to, for example, extract information from raw data. And better algorithms also mean that there's more and more value to collecting more and more, more and more data to collect more and more information from that data. And the problem is with this privacy-eating monster, once information is in it, it cannot be removed. If you put stuff on the internet, it's there and it becomes difficult to delete it again. You can put it into a semi-public area, but the chances are good that it will become public one day, or at least will stay in the semi-public area for a very long time. And you're never sure if maybe not someone will steal the data and collect it for the privacy-eating monster. So this is the one actor in this game, and then we have the other actor, that is the privacy defending army. And if we are for privacy, we would hope that they would be victorious, but unfortunately their weapons, one can argue about the efficiency of the weapons. Laws are ineffective, national laws cannot deal with the international nature of cyberspace, and international laws suffer from slow bureaucracy that cannot react as quickly as the machinery grows and grows, and technology is insecure, as we learn every day, for example, if we go to this Congress, where it is again and again shown how technology that we hope would enhance our privacy can be made insecure, can be broken, and so on. So, for example, you might have the best encryption algorithm, but you're never sure, maybe Moore's Law will defeat it one day, or maybe some smart mathematician will come up with an idea to beat it that you had not foreseen. The new generation seems to care less and less about this old thing, privacy. They grow up in social networks where they learn that it's cool to put their information online for many people to see and to interact in ways that are very much informational exhibitionism. And the older generation that still values privacy more, of course, becomes less and less important in the battle. So, from the side of the army, it's an uneven battle because it cannot be won ultimately. You can never defend privacy with certainty forever because there's always a chance that it will be broken and you're never sure that it will be secure forever. And on the other hand, this battle can be lost very easily. That is, you only have to do not enough right now to lose privacy. And since we learned this privacy-eating monster eats information and never gives it away again, once the privacy is lost, it seems very difficult, if not impossible, to get it again. So privacy is doomed, and we can say goodbye to it, and maybe it's a sad story. But now we can look at this thing that we had in the past, privacy, and what did it mean? What did it mean for us? And what would it mean if it's lost? Well, actually, what is the meaning of privacy? Actually, people started thinking about the meaning of privacy for only very recently in the way that in the modern meaning. So privacy came into its puberty maybe at the end of the 19th century and grew up in the 20th century. And the core idea maybe of privacy is self-determination. That is, we want to make sure that people have the freedom to make their own decisions about a personal area of their life and free from interference by others, like, for example, the state or people they don't know, outside world. And so this is a very practical definition of privacy. That's basically equivalent to saying we value personal freedom. So, for example, in the US, the right to abortion was decided by the Supreme Court as something that is protected by privacy, because the decision of a woman to abort her child is something that's her personal choice and that's not a matter of the state. But for example, at a place like the Congress, the thing that the other important attribute of privacy that we take into consideration and that may be important for the self-determination thing is information control. That is, we want to control what information flows from us to others, what others know about us, because the idea is that knowledge is power, and knowledge about my personal matters, therefore, is in a way an inappropriate power about my personal matters. And also the control that flows from others to me. That is, for example, if you are in your private space, you don't want to have certain information intrude on you, for example, someone calling you and trying to sell you something also, or people telling you too much about their private lives, that we also consider in a breach of privacy in a certain way. And then, of course, a third important attribute of privacy is intimacy, which can be defined very easily as the sharing of privacy. That is, we decide that with some people we interact more closely in information flow, and we have a trust for them, so we tell them a little more about us and about our personal life than we would tell others. And we also maybe allow them to meddle a little more into our personal affairs than we would allow others. So that's some abstract theoretical ideas about what privacy was. Let's look at some historical examples. I think what one can take very easily as one good traditional space of privacy is your home with your family. That's a kind of intimate space, it's a shared privacy. And some other examples, I give you some other examples, but the important thing is that mostly we talk about spaces of privacy, which are distinguished from spaces which are not private, which are public. And some examples, private spaces would also be, for example, a back room in a coffee house where you can hide some things and people can go and only certain people can go, but not all the people who visit the coffee house. Or, for example, your home PC with all your porn on it, or your head brain with your thoughts that hopefully no telepath can ever intrude on. Whereas in the public spaces, you have, for example, forums, parliaments, newspapers, /dot. And the distinguishing thing is that the one thing is hidden or has a space that is hidden from outside view, whereas the public space is visible from outside view. So what value does that provide to things like, for example, freedom? Well, the first idea that comes to mind is the private space seems to be secure from scrutiny of outside norms, of social norms, whereas the public space is accountable to these very same social norms. So you might have the idea, in the private space, I have a certain freedom that I do not have in the public space. I can do stuff, I can enjoy my tentacle porn in the private space, but I cannot enjoy it in the public space because there it would enrage some people who do not like tentacle porn. So it would be easy to assume, well, someone is a free individual in the private space, whereas he is a controlled conformist in the public space. So that's a very easy dichotomy. But I don't think it's 100% true. So, for example, look historically at what kinds of persons belonged to the private household and what kinds of persons belonged to the public. You have this division, for example. Traditionally, the wife should stay at home and there, in a way, stay in privacy, whereas the man lives in public and the political sphere and so on. So would you say that the woman is really the person who enjoys more freedom than the man? Maybe not. Maybe it's not so easy to just say private space is a space of freedom where you can do everything, whereas the public you are controlled and have no possibilities to live a free life. But I think another important aspect of privacy that can come through is that private space is very often somewhat isolated. There's only a small space where you can do only certain things. You can do these certain things very freely, but there are other things that you can do only in the interconnectedness of a public space. For example, enjoy some things that you can only enjoy in the communication with many people. So another, I think, interesting example to shake up a little common assumptions about the freedom value of privacy would be comparing closet homosexuality to a gay pride parade. So you have people who are forced in a homophobic society to live their identity in privacy, and whereas you would say that if they can make a gay pride parade, that is certainly a more free image, and that is certainly a more free society. So you would say that a homophobic society offers less freedom, whereas a more tolerant society offers more freedom. And the interesting thing is, how did homosexuality create its freedom to, for example, make a gay pride parade? Not by enhancing the walls of privacy and hiding more and more, but actually through the voluntary coming out, or the involuntary outing of more and more people as homosexuals in the public sphere. So I think after looking at some of these attributes and examples, I must conclude that privacy is of ambiguous value at best for things like freedom or identity. Identity is another thing, because privacy always assumes that there is this personal core that you have to respect, and that is basically what makes you the person that you are. And one can argue whether you really have a one certain static personal core that has to be respected and that is not connected and defined by the environment. So anyway, this is a thing of the past. We don't have to worry about it anymore. But let's look at the world that may be coming, in a post-private world. I think one could create some optimistic ideas about what such a world would look like by looking at the way the information economy nowadays starts to work. Privacy is an instrument of information, so maybe we should look at some examples of current information economies. For example, we have this idea that sharing is a good idea, and that sharing may be a better idea than prohibitively protecting or hiding information. So you have the idea of a non-zero-sum game in the new current information economies, where it is better to give, that is, you cannot lose information, but you can let other people participate in the information and share the information, and that you get more back by sharing information than by hiding information. So there is the idea that more information may actually, in many circumstances, be better than less information. For example, markets run better if there's more information provided and, of course, distributed somewhat evenly. And maybe information also becomes more valuable even to the owner, who has to give up some privacy of the information if it is shared. So, for example, he can inform people about what he likes, and thereby people can better give him what he likes than if they would not know what he likes. So that is an example of an information that, if shared, is more valuable to the owner. And now look at what becomes of the information machinery around us, this growing intelligence that collects more and more information and also interconnects us more and more with other people who look closely at our intelligence and interconnect with that. So I think I like the sci-fi image of the hive mind, that is some kind of global intelligence of many, many minds connected. Something like the Borg, maybe, but maybe the Borg image is somewhat imperfect if we compare it to what is really happening right now. So anyway, the interconnected network of many minds and many informations and many intelligences is growing and growing and growing, even if you participate or if you do not participate. If you interconnect your intelligence, your knowledge, your thinking with it, or if you do not. So you cannot fight it by abstaining from it, but maybe you can earn something from participating in it. That is, you can participate in a growing superintelligence that that offers you more intellectual and knowledge potential than you would have in your own isolated mind. And that may be a good thing, having superintelligence available to you, and also providing your own viewpoint of things into this superintelligence, instead of refusing to share your viewpoint of things with this intelligence, because thereby you can make sure that a piece of your identity may be in this hive mind instead of not being in this hive mind. You may gain more by participating than you lose. So the question is, what might you lose? Well, some ideas would be maybe you lose some individuality or autonomy. So that's basically the idea that by participating in this new growing social consciousness, you become more conformistic and somewhat less weird because you conform more to social norms. So I wonder if that is really what is happening. Here's some furries to scare you and to maybe make you think about the next slide. That is that this social space that you are interconnected into is actually getting redefined in what normality means for it. So you have this case, you have the old case where you say in a collectivistic totalitarian state, it basically tries to put conformism on everyone who participates in it and who is part of it. Whereas I would say that right now we have more a situation, for example, in the internet, where many people participate in one huge social sphere and social interconnectedness, but not in a way that makes them more and more alike, but actually in a way that enforces difference. Because to the growing information machinery, difference is good because difference is information. The machine grows by gathering more and more intelligence and by learning more and more about unexpected things. It likes things that it are not yet known by it, because through that it can grow further and further. So difference is information, difference is good, and thereby actually it craves difference, and thereby we do not have a situation where people are forced into conforming, but more in a situation where the individuality or the individuality of your personality is something that is valuable to this machine. So you have the situation where we are more working with making the world that you communicate conform to your individual worldview, like in the case of personalization, than of making you conform to the world. So in a way, the new normality is actually a lack of normality that presses you into being alike with each other. There is no escape from this ever-increasing diversity, because the more people with individuality that are integrated into the system, the more these people's individuality is increased. And for example, they find other people who share the same weird fetishes with them, and so that affirms them in their interests, and they can exchange tentacle porn, and thereby their fetish for tentacle porn can grow even further and deeper, and they become more and more different from other people who are not like them. So, and if this diversity is growing and growing and growing, and society has to deal with that, that forces society to become more tolerant, because society would otherwise be not flexible enough to keep all its participants together, and it would collapse. So the old privacy example of you should worry about what happens with your data on the internet, because one day you wouldn't find a job because your employer will see that you are really weird and do stupid things. I think one can question this assumption, because first of all, the employer would not find any untarnished candidates, because the world is post-private and every weirdness is at once brought out to the open. And we can very much assume that every person has nowadays something to hide, because every person in her own personal way is somewhat weird or somewhat stupid or somewhat non-conformistic or somewhat criminal. One can assume that either the employer has many candidates who are all a little weird and he has to accept that, or he chooses candidates who do not have any data on them on the net. And I don't think that this would reassure him that these are good candidates, but more it would make him suspicious, because someone who has not records on him may be someone who has done something really, really, really bad and had to have this hide that. So this person may, with the empty record, may actually be the person who is worse off. And on the other hand, since in this new information society, difference is good and thereby the unexpected is good, the employer might actually want people who offer originality, because everything else can be outsourced or automatized. So if behavior is predictable, you can write an algorithm for it in a way, or you can outsource it to people who do not have to provide very much new intelligence to the problems that you are having. But if you have to deal with unpredictable situations, and then you have to have people who can create, who can act spontaneously in new ways and can offer new solutions, and that can be only found in people who are willing to open themselves, for example, to difference and to deal with unexpected situations and so on. And I think that can be more easily found in people that, according to current definitions, would be considered weird or nerds or something like that, than in people who conform totally and never have problems fitting into any society that surrounds them. So then we have the question of identity, and of course, if we say privacy is important to protect your identity and to make sure that your identity grows in a healthy way, that that you grow to be someone different from the others, then we can look at what happens to identity right now already. So I think identity becomes more fluent and more volatile. So, for example, you have the situations where people, where one human can constitute many different identities. Of course, we had that in the past. We had always this assumption that people play many different roles in many different social contexts. But it's become more and more not only a question of playing different roles, but really of creating and constituting complete, full-blown personalities. So in a way, we were trained through that in the past by, for example, role-playing games, and we went from that to really learning how to define ourselves, for example, in profiles, on profile pages of different social networks, and by creating somewhat different personality for each social network. And now we have situations where, for example, people can have an identity in Second Life, and that is an identity that is fully functional, not only a game, a playing, but something, for example, that can generate money for them, that can participate in an economy, can participate in politics, and still this is a completely different personality than, for example, they would have when they deal with their family. I think this is enforced more and more by the freedoms of the digital space to play and to enact and to constitute new identities. And you also have the other situations where identities are constituted not by one human, but by many humans. So think, for example, of Anonymous, where you have some very strange multi-person identity where you cannot find a single core to make responsible, for example, through law, to bring to justice, because you have one identity that is mapped in a very complex way to the brains of many humans, and especially to a changing set of humans. So in a way, you lose the idea of a static core identity that is what you really are and what you will always be, and that is, for example, what you were born into because of your genetics and because of your inherent goodness or your inherent morality. Instead, you have more and more dynamism in your identity. So, for example, the fact that on Twitter you have a very, very fine mapping of your mood changes over minutes in some cases means that it becomes more and more difficult to create one coherent image of your identity. It's more like you change very spontaneously what makes you. So you may have a situation where, for example, the identification of who you are psychologically, politically, or something like that changes very quickly, because you have recordings of everything, but you spontaneously change your opinion, or you change your opinion for good reasons, and later these recordings show what opinion you had or what your identity was maybe a year ago, but you cannot really take that anymore as a source to identify what your opinion is now, what your identity is now. So even though everything is recorded about us forever, and we could say, and I could tell you what opinion you had on a certain matter 20 years ago, or I could tell you what you liked or what you did not like 10 minutes ago, it is more and more acceptable that this changes, that this becomes more fluent. You also have the case of that a certain identity may change its hosts, or in a way that identities are not really forced to stay at one human organism. So you have more and more, for example, the case of fake identities and social networks, where you can, which start out as jokes, or which start out as a way of identity theft to politically hurt someone, for example. But more and more people really take this supposed play very seriously and really try to enact what they think someone could be, or what someone could say about a certain matter. And this to a degree that you can actually rely on this fake identity just as much as you can rely on your image of the true identity. So, for example, you have artists or politicians, philosophers also, and so on, who have profiles, for example, on MySpace. And they may be dead, which is sad, so you cannot get any new information about the workings of their interior intelligence anymore. But you have someone who really is very good at making a simulation of this identity. And if you get the very same answers that you get from the simulation that you would get from the real identity, it doesn't matter anymore that the biological host of this identity is dead. So in a way, I think identities should be considered something like memes that can also flow from person to person to person and can actually be considered somewhat independent of their hosts. You would no more be imprisoned in your identity. That is, you could be what you spontaneously want to be, what's fun to be, not what you supposedly are. So you would not have to be nailed down to this core identity, and people would tell you, that's unlike you, you shouldn't act in this way. Or people cannot tell you, you should remember where you come from, because that is your one true identity that creates what you are and that will forever be written into you. So identities becoming more volatile may mean more freedom to act the way you want to right now, and it may lead to actually losing this idea of an I as something that has to define what your actions are. It might also mean something like the end of guilt, because it's impossible to hold some person responsible for consciously doing something if that person is no more and instead is another person. So these are, I think, very utopian and ideas that are very speculative, and I am not sure that that's actually what will win ground in the next decades, but I think it's something to start at, thinking about what a post-private society could look like. But of course we have more pressing matters right now, for example in the idea of the dangers of the surveillance state. So one could say that a sign like that, which says caution, you are under video surveillance, very clearly tells you we gather information about you and we do it to control you. And that is certainly something that is not enhancing your personal freedom, and that is certainly something that is there to reduce your personal freedom. So some other ideas about post-privacy, exactly in connection with this problem of the surveillance state, were, for example, stated yesterday by John Gilmore when he talked about David Brin's The Transparent Society. And that is a very good book that I recommend everyone to read, and I want to also delve a little into these ideas. So for example, you have the idea of surveillance, that is the top looking at the bottom, and the top meaning the more powerful, the one with the monopoly on the use of violence. And you have other ideas, for example, you have the ideas of surveillance, which would be basically the bottom looking also, or equivalence, which is the balance of both sides looking around them and looking at each other. So this is, for example, what happens when you watch or document actions of police. For example, the Rodney King videotape is a good example of that. And you try to make sure through that, for example, police act in a good way with people and not in a way that is unlawful and unjust. And that is actually, it's very interesting that of course violates in a way the privacy of the policeman. And you have societies where the value of transparency seems to be bigger than the value of the privacy of the policeman. But you also have, for example, in Germany, you have sometimes the case where it's argued that privacy is very, very important, and one should not give out the identification of certain policemen when in their action, because that would violate their privacy. Or you should not take pictures of policemen, because that would violate their privacy. So here we have a case where I think many people can agree that transparency is actually more important than privacy to protect freedom. There's also another interesting case that is document yourself. In a way, do the job of the surveillance state for the surveillance state by filming yourself what you do. And that may sound very, very dark. In a way, it sounds like, well, we have internalized the control and the surveillance so much that now we have to, we are giving up even the freedom to think for ourselves, because we would even write down our thoughts, because we are the only people who can document ourselves so profoundly like that. But you have, for example, cases like Hassan Eli, who is an Arab American artist who had problems with the FBI, and they suspected him, and I think they would not let him fly, or they asked him, and so he missed his plane or something like that, because they suspected, well, maybe he's a terrorist, you know, he's an Arab, he looks Arab, and so very, very surely he might be a terrorist. And what he did, he started to really document every single moment of his life. He lets himself track over the internet 24 hours a day. He takes pictures in very short intervals all around, so people know where he's going, who he's talking to, and so on. And in a way, that serves as an alibi, because there's the police first, of course, knows, oh, okay, he's okay, we know about him, he went there and there, he did not interact with these suspicious characters, so we can leave him free. But you also have the situation that in a way he is, if someone would say, well, we suspect him, and because we suspect him, we are forced to, for example, imprison him to make sure that he does not run away, then you can say, well, no, I'm treated in an unjust way, because as everyone can see, I am not a suspicious character. So in a way, he uses self-documentation as a way of protection. Then, of course, this whole idea of transparency as a means for freedom, there is, I think, the most important thing is that what needs to be transparent is everything that has a certain force. So, for example, the force of surveillance. The idea that surveillance should be transparent. You should know about where the camera is and what it records and for whom it records and who reads your diary and so on. And that's a basic necessity for at least not feeling intimidated too much by surveillance. And for example, you could say it, open the camera feed, so we want to know what you people are seeing. You could also say, of course, open the camera feeds, because we too want to participate in the surveillance, and we want to know what our neighbor is doing in his garden. But the important thing in this case is that every case where something creates power and has power over society or in society should be transparent. And the more power something has, the more transparent it should be. So that's the idea that freedom can actually enhance by transparency, and that in a case where the surveillance becomes total, the transparency should become total. So that John Gilmore yesterday talked about that, would be, at least if we cannot protect ourselves from the surveillance state, then at least we should make sure that the surveillance is total and that we can look back at the people who watch us. So he liked privacy, but he said if privacy is lost, then at least that's better than the alternative. And of course the question is if what kinds of then if it's in a society with this kind of transparency, would there be any secrets at all? For example, would there be military secrets? Would the state agree to say, well, okay, we watch you, but we also allow to watch us and watch, for example, what happens in our military installations or what our secret service, which would be an oxymoron in that case, does or something like that. So, but that's still a matter that is somewhat grey and where it's somewhat difficult to really become a friend of these ideas. But maybe I think one can find another more positive post-privacy perspective to the problem of surveillance, and that is control versus trust. I have forgotten whether it was Stalin or Lenin or some communist dictator said that trust is good, control is better. I think we know that sentence, but what actually is the difference between control versus trust? And I actually think it's a difference of information, because if you have a lack of information, that means you have something to fear, you have something to be suspicious of. That creates mistrust, and that means you feel more need to control things because things act in a way that is too complex for you to predetermine. And that means, for example, if you know that you can only view a small percentage of all the potential crimes happening, then you have watch a small percentage of crimes happening and thereby control a small percentage of crimes happening, that therefore you have to punish these few crimes that you catch, these few criminals that you catch, even more strongly to deter other criminals. So that's the idea that if you make strong punishments that will deter criminals, an idea that one can argue maybe does not work so perfectly, because criminals care more for whether they are caught or not than for what kind of punishment may wait for them in line at the end of being caught. So most criminals more think about in the lines of I think it's pretty safe doing that because there's a very, very small percentage of me getting caught, than in the way of, well, of course, the chance that I get caught is very high, but the punishment that expects me is also very little. So, and also you have to do many somewhat general or somewhat broad laws, because you have to catch many potential cases in which you do not know exactly whether they may be harmful or not, but since you know so few about the, because you know not very much about the situation, you are forced to provide more security by catching every possible case instead of only the few cases where really something harmful happens. So I think that a lack of information may actually in some cases lead to less information, because you have a few information and these informations are enough to make you suspicious, but actually, for example, if you would know a little more about a person, additionally to the information that you already have, you might become less suspicious towards that person, because you know, well, of course he likes to buy books about explosives and so on, but he's just a chemistry nerd and he's never done anything harmful with that. So that make you less suspicious and less fearful about this person. So actually, more information, that is my idea, can create more freedom through trust, because the more information you have about someone, the more reason you have to trust him. There is less reason to assume that this person might do something harmful to you if he has never done anything harmful and if he only interacts with you in a harmless way and in a positive way. That is, the more information you have about a matter, the less you fear the matter. Ignorance creates fear, and knowledge creates trust. And so in a society where there is more information and more trust, you would actually have less need for strict control or deterrence, because as a result, first, you would catch a higher percentage of the crimes permitted, So the use of deterrence would be smaller. You would not have the case as you had in the Middle Ages, where you know you catch only 1 in 100 criminals, and the few criminals that you do catch need to be quartered and burned and so on to really give a brutal example to the other criminals that you cannot catch. But you could just, for example, punish every criminal act only in a way that is absolutely equivalent to the harm done, and not something much more, a punishment that is much, much, much worse than the harm done. And you only need relatively few laws for very precise cases, because you know exactly what is harmful or what may be harmful. So you would have less laws, and I think less laws which act more precise and which punish more easily in the sense that the punishments are not as strong and as brutal, could actually mean more freedom. I think that's a hypothesis that can create lots of criticism and create lots of contrary opinions, but I think it's something worth thinking about, especially considering, for example, that the word trust was an earlier Congress motto, and I've always wondered how we can create more trust. Maybe we would just, if in the future we are all victims to the all-seeing eye in a post-private society, that may be something dangerous, that may be something dystopian, but I think one can create ideas and one can brainstorm ideas about how this could also be something utopian. So then now, only a short slide, I want to give some reading recommendations concerning privacy and the division between privacy and public and so on. I recommend the privacy article in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is online. That's a very comprehensive and yet very short and very short but very complete overview about the field of what people are thinking about privacy in law, in philosophy, and so on. Also, something like that is in the format of a book is The Value of Privacy, or in German, Der Wert des Privaten by Beate Rösler. I think it appeared in English and as well as in German. And then another interesting example, The Fall of Public Man by Richard Sennett, which provides a very interesting history of the division between private spaces and public spaces and how that interacts with the psychology of humans in societies and so on, from the French Revolution to the Puritanism of the 19th century, to the neo-Puritanism of the 19th century and so on, and to the omnipresent intimacy, for example, in the media in the 20th century. And he's very critical to this, to a certain powers of intimacy and privacy, and values potentials of the public space very much. Then a very interesting recent study that I can recommend, Facebook and the Social Dynamics of Privacy, which tries to look into how people are actually... how people are actually... evaluating their privacy and what they actually think, what kind of privacy they have in a social network like, for example, Facebook, and how privacy is broken in these networks, especially because people have false expectations about privacy and false expectations that are not so much a result of manipulation through Facebook, but through mechanisms, psychological mechanisms of sociality and so on. And that's also online. And also, as I mentioned already, The Transparent Society by David Brin, which really is a very controversial, offers very controversial arguments concerning why transparency could be much more important than privacy, which also somewhat states that privacy is not so much a condition for freedom, but that actually freedom is a condition for the luxury of privacy. So... I turned this thing off now. So I think we have some minutes left, and I guess there may be some opposition to what I've said, so feel free to...
Well, unsurprisingly, I'm quite a bit irritated about what you've been telling, because it sounds to me like... as there is no reasonable way that things could work out the way we would like them to, let's look at a radically opposite direction. And I'm, while not really being sure how that might look like, because I'm not convinced at all that, for example, it might be politically easier to convince the police that they let themselves film battering people at a demonstration, than it would be, for example, especially in the actual political context, to fight for serious laws that prohibit all the data terrorism that has been going on, with all that data that is traded and lost, with some real touchable consequences for real people. So I don't think that this is neither a timely nor a realistic suggestion. What's your take on that?
First, I agree with the difficulty to make sure the police is victim to the same transparency that the citizen is. That's, of course, I think, something one should fight about, and something that one should fight at least as much about as protecting the privacy of the citizen. And then, of course, yeah, the whole thing is speculation and utopianism. It's not that I say, well, I have now found the solution for the problems and just ignore our old fight and just embrace post-privacy openly and just have the old ideas being done with. I just wanted to throw in some ideas about how this could work out in a nice way, so that if we, for example, find out that it becomes more and more difficult to protect freedom on the one front, then maybe we should try to enforce positive developments on the other front. So if it becomes difficult to protect freedom through privacy, then we should also look at maybe it becomes easier and thereby more effective to protect freedom in other ways that are somewhat maybe different than the privacy angle.
Okay. I have a question. I think we can easily achieve or get more transparency from a democratic government. But how do we get transparency from multinationals or more authoritarian governments?
Yeah, that's basically the same problem. Of course, you may say in a democracy it's easier to enforce transparency than it's concerning entities like corporations or autocracies. In this case, I'd say, well, actually, on the one hand, one can hope that technology creates some new potentials, that, for example, more ubiquitous recording of everything that is available to more and more people, for example, in the form of mobile phone cameras and so on, creates by itself better and better opportunities for transparency, not necessarily in a legal framework, but in a way that it gets published on the web, and once it's on the web, it doesn't get away again. But still, that might be a difficult fight. So to force transparency on those who do not want it, it's hopefully also a difficult fight right now to force transparency on the people who are not in the power above, but. But the people who are strong as legal entities and as corporations and so on may actually fight even more effectively against becoming transparent than, for example, political movements that try to protect the privacy of individual persons.
One question. I really like the concept of equivalence, suggesting that there is some kind of balance between them watching us and us watching them. But what I missed on that point was the opportunity to have larger access to media, because it's not only to have a look at what, for example, politicians, police forces, etc., are doing and how they are treating us, but it's also a look on the mechanisms of public of the press, for example, of discourses inside the society, and I miss the equality there. And if I consider the terrorist debate yesterday, is not new. We had this terrorist debate last year here too, and we have here a few thousand people having access to modern media and having more impact there than normal internet users outside this event. And we didn't manage to turn over the discussion about what is terrorism. That was that's still the discourse that politics and mass media are setting, still the agenda. And we have the opportunities to watch how this is done. We have the opportunities to describe how it is done, but there is still no equality because we don't have the reach, and I don't see how we should achieve this reach.
I think we have a case where traditional hierarchies of media are where traditional hierarchies of media are changing very much, and as a result of new technologies. And right now you don't have a situation where you are totally satisfied with, because you still have, for example, a very strong mainstream press, and you still have some very important gatekeeper bottlenecks that decide what information reaches many people. But I think technology really develops in a way that makes it more and more difficult to enforce these bottlenecks.
It works now? Okay, thank you. I would just like to offer an agreement to you, because I'm Swedish, and since the 60s, my social security number is a matter of public record, so nobody's using it as anything secure. I can also walk in to any parts of government and ask for their records. I mean, that's by law, and they have to give it to me very readily, so within a few hours they should produce a record I'm asking them for, and this is in law, and this has worked very well, and so we have the transparency both ways. I can go in and see a lot about what the government is doing, and I know when we joined the EU, this was a disruptive force, because governments in Europe were sending records to Swedish government, and then media was going in and asking for the records, and then all of a sudden it was public. So I think that what we should do is not say governments are eternally evil. Instead, we should make sure government are benevolent and working for us, and we should have access to what they're doing, and because they have access to what we're doing. So I totally agree with you in your is the thing that we need privacy because government is evil, and trying to solve that by increasing the privacy. We should do it the other way around. We should have benevolent government instead.
Yeah, so I think it would be interesting to collect some examples where this transparency thing really works out. So it may work out in your case. Maybe one can also find examples where it collapses disastrously and where it leads to collapse of society. But for example, what David Brin, for example, argues in his book is that it's very difficult to find a society which is open and which through that openness descends into totalitarianism, whereas it's quite easy to in the case that the openness really creates some form of trust and some form of security for freedom through transparency, where it's very difficult, where it's very easy in cases where there is no transparency totally, and there it's possible for example, private institutions to develop the challenge, the freedom of the society, and in that case, it may very well happen that the society collapses into an autocracy. So it's very interesting maybe to collect examples of states where it works out and of states where it maybe not working out. So we're finished, and thank you everybody, and have much fun with the next talk.